This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
Jay Buhner just punched me in the kidney.
Power through the Alaska Airlines studio.
On Seattle Sports.
Well, we're going to do you on the interview.
Don't really work that way, Sherm. This is a show that has my name on it.
It kind of does, though.
Brought to you by Simply Seattle.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
Hello!
All right, well, Brock, unfortunately, we went so long with Mr. Klatt that we didn't have the opportunity to do Blue 88 when we're supposed to at 7:45. Hopefully nobody was too disappointed. They were at least getting some football content during that time. But I thought that we would do a little late edition of Blue 88. In fact, we'll do it right now.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
All right, Brock, question number one. One thing that we've talked about, and I know at least one of the Seahawks has mentioned it as well, is that this coaching staff under Mike McDonald does not look a lot like we thought it would. There aren't a lot of guys that he's worked with in the past. How do you think that came to be, and how important is it?
Yeah, I think there's two people that played a significant role, maybe three. Number one being Jody Allen. Before I give you the other two, this was Pharaoh Brown, tight end, run blocking tight end of your Seattle Seahawks, who certainly noticed it. He's kicked around the league. He's been with a bunch of organizations. He's seen the good old boy club. Just the relationship game where, hey, man, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine, keep me all employed. That's not the way this staff looks. Here was Pharaoh talking about it.
It's amazing. It's an amazing energy. And I tell you this, this is a great story because it's so unconventional what we see in the league. A lot of times when you get these coaching staff hirings, you get a lot of loyalty stuff. You know, it's kind of like a loyalty business. You got guys that you're comfortable with. Mike went out and interviewed all prospects and hired who he thought the best was. So now we have a building environment where nobody is connected from previous stops. He didn't bring the people from Baltimore. He went out and hired who he thought was the best at each position. So you got a bunch of great, you got a bunch of individuals who bring in all these different things. So now it's like when you talk about building a foundation, it seems authentic. It seems real because now coaches are building, players are building, front office is building. It's all new. So.
Yeah, I think one of the little nuggets over the last few months that jumped out to me, and maybe I'm running with something that's not there, but it's just my gut feeling on this, was when John Schneider dropped just a little nugget, and I think it was his first interview when he held that first press conference by himself, and he said, now I'm going to be in charge of the hiring process. And talking about the hiring of the coaches, right, where a lot of that was Pete. When it came to that war room, it has been John. You know, Trent Kirshner and those guys talked about it in their pre-draft interview last week. Like, hey, man, if you saw what and how this all went down the last 14 years, you would see this is John Schneider's show. This is his game day. These draft days, this war room, this is his preparation, his time, his Super Bowl. But, you know, he was not in charge of hiring the coaches. That was Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll was the one who did all of that. So I think this is very much what Pharaoh Brown is speaking to. It's very much a John Schneider and a Jody Allen. And then I throw in one other name, man, Nick Saban. Nick Saban did what he did at Alabama because Nick Saban went outside the box. And he hired the best people, not the ones that he had relationship with, the ones that he studied and went, they do something amazing. I want that. I want that. And I think the best case is Ryan Grubb. I think Mike McDonald, look at what he did in Washington the last few years. Look at what he did at Fresno State. Look at what he's done with Kalen DeBoer all the way along. Like, I want that. That's been really fruitful for years and years and years in a number of different places. I may not know him. We may have to have some beers across the street at Dino's, but eventually I want what that guy has. So kudos to Pharaoh Brown for noticing it. I'm sure those other players on the team do as well.
All right, question number two. Are you buying this? Michael Penix on with Colin Cowherd explaining why he didn't run a lot in college.
If you watch my high school tape, then yeah, I'll be like, okay, yeah, I ran more. But once I got to college, you know, it was that. For me, I always want to highlight the guys around me. You know, I feel like I'm the best at elevating everybody around me, and that's what I look to do each and every day. So, you know, I got the best receivers in the league, and I had the best offensive line. So, you know, it's no sense for me to run around. And if I don't got to do it in my legs, I can do it in my arm. You know, it's easy to do that. You know, I got everybody else, you know, excited, knowing that the ball can come to them at any point in time. So, you know, I get my reads real fast. So, you know, I get to the point where, you know, if I do got to run, I can. You know, like you said, you know, I showed it at the pro day, but and if I don't got to run, I got these guys around me. You know, I'm gonna make sure I highlight them with the ball.
You buying it?
I buy that, and it's a yes, and it's not a but. It's an and. Yes, and I want to protect myself. Yes, I totally buy that. I want to be the facilitator. I want to be the point guard. I got all this talent around me. And guess what? Option one's open, two's open, three's open, four's open. Got a run game, got two NFL tackles. Of course, I want to be the facilitator. And I want to protect myself. Because when I exposed my body to contact, I tore my ACL and I tore my ACL. And three of my four seasons in Indiana ended before the season was over. I'm not doing that again. So it's not a yes, but it's a yes. And I get to protect myself along the way. Question number three. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm taking Brock's this over. Taking over. Question number three.
All right, Salty.
You're hitting me up with a question?
I'm hitting you up.
Oh, wow.
I'm hitting a little spot, too. Mm. I know one that's going to get you.
Yeah.
How much did you appreciate and enjoy Richard Sherman's response to Picturegate?
I appreciated it quite a bit, I guess I would say. If you didn't get a chance to read it, I, of course, couldn't read it when it first came out because I'm still blocked by Richard Sherman. But here was his response to another fan who said, hey, it's really not that big a deal. Other coaches have done this. And he says, yeah, I'm sure every great franchise is removing its legendary players' pictures from their building because they can't ever live up to that. Makes sense. Sure, the Ravens don't have pictures of Ray Lewis and that great defense. I'm sure Pittsburgh doesn't have pictures of all the great moments. I'm sure Dallas, San Francisco, New England all remove pictures of the history of their franchise because of a new coach. Makes sense. That's from Richard Sherman. Then he says, and Pete hung a Super Bowl banner. No other coach in the franchise history has done that, but it's on brand. Mm. On brand. All right, I got a lot of responses to this. I'll try to keep it brief, and I think I'm going to write about this tonight at seattlesports.com. First of all, obviously, Sherm doesn't know the whole story. Shocker that Sherm speaks before he doesn't know the whole story. Secondly, don't tell me for a minute that Richard Sherman cares about the Seahawks. He doesn't. You know what Richard Sherman cares about? Richard Sherman. And he's made that clear in any number of ways in the past. And this is just another example of it. He doesn't care whether this team wins more games in the future. Quite frankly, I think he'd be happy if this team doesn't win more games in the future, because what Sherm's all about is proving how great he was and how right he was. And all he wants is for everybody to know that the greatest era of Seahawks football was when Richard Sherman was a part of it. So I love how he's talking now, like he loves and respects Pete and the franchise. Please, where was that when you were here? Where was that? Or should they hang a picture of him pushing his whole team and throwing a temper tantrum after he messed up a coverage against Atlanta? Maybe they could put up a plaque for the Kumbaya room.
Wasn't his fault.
What does on brand mean? What does that even mean? On brand for who? Schneider? The franchise? Jody Allen, Mike McDonald, you already know what's on brand for him.
You know what's beautiful? That's Blue 88. Is I could wind you up and you could go for an hour. I could wind you up on this one. And
I can't believe you're not letting me go for an hour. This was my plan for the entire 8 a.m. hour, was just to talk about this because it's so freaking absurd. I would have spent the entire hour talking about it. As it is, it'll be a labor of love to write this column later tonight. Richard Sherman, all about himself for a huge shocking change.
Text in if you're mad at us for curbing Salk from talking about Richard Sherman.
Did anybody want to hear at least a full segment of me and my thoughts about those comments from Richard Sherman?
Yeah, I think if you and me, Amora and Justin, would have guessed when the story in a Picturegate came out, which former Seahawk would have the hardest time with it, I think it would have been a unanimous.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. Yes. Yeah, it's funny. I last week we were saying, I wonder if this is just a straw man. It feels like nobody in their right mind is actually upset about it. And I guess that's still true. We've yet to find somebody in their right mind who's actually upset about this. We'll come back with everything you need to know. It's Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Well, you probably already know some of this, but you should know that the Mariners had themselves a really nice weekend. Could have been even better, to be honest. Could have been even better. They could have won that middle game on Sunday. But give them credit. They went 2 out of 3. That's what you got to do. Keep stringing together series wins. They've now won 7 of 10. They've won 5 of 6. And their pitching has been the biggest predominant reason why. It has been fantastic. One game after another after another. 10 straight excellent starts. 9 of the 10 quality starts. That's who they are, and that's how they were built.
That's who we are. We have outstanding pitching. We have played really good defense. Even the play, the double play that J.P. Crawford turned there in the ninth inning, like, that is a special play. You can't take those plays for granted. But all over the field, Julio's been great in center field. Rojas been really good at first. I mean, you know, Ty makes a great pick on a ball earlier today. Our defense has really helped our pitching along. Our pitchings are good, but when your defense plays that well, now you can hold teams in one or two runs, and then you don't have to have a whole lot of offense to win ballgame.
There's no doubt, Brock, as the defense has gotten better, it has certainly helped the pitching and helped their team in general.
Chicken or the egg? Is it the elite pitching so the defense isn't asked to do 100 things, or is it, you know, the defense?
The defense has actually gotten better.
Yeah, no,
it was
definitely.
Really bad pitch, regardless of the pitching. Pitching didn't help, but the defense was independently bad in the first week or so.
Well, it was pretty bad offense in the first week or so, too, just chasing and strikeout rates off the charts and everything else. And since then, well, there's been a whole lot more traffic on the base paths, a whole lot more walks. Still not a huge amount of home runs, but a lot more pressure, a lot more hitting. And man, Cal Raleigh, he likes Toronto, and he liked hitting at 5,000 feet.
Seemed to. Yeah, he was pretty nasty, as was J.P. Crawford, and Julio had been pretty good as well. So no home runs yet, but starting to pile up more hits and raising his average and kind of doing what he needs to do. Yeah, they allowed a total of 4 runs in the series. They scored 20 of them. So look, you went 20-4 in terms of runs.
Yeah, that scoring differential looks a little better.
Yeah, it's back to positive, right, which is a good sign. You're not going to, you know, it's frustrating a little bit to lose one of the 3 games, but you keep outscoring teams 20-4 in a series, you're going to win a whole lot more than you lose. They go to Texas now after a day off today, and they're going to throw Logan Gilbert and Bryce Miller and Luis Castillo in the 3 games there. So I kind of got my wish with this rainout, right? I was wondering if they might kind of switch some things to get Luis there.
It was a snow out.
Excuse me. And I got it. Got what I wanted, which is Luis Castillo in Texas.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Right, draft week, Brock, is certainly here. Been enjoying some of what I've been reading here the last couple of days. And mock drafts, Jordan Reed has his out today. He has the Seahawks trading back to 20 and then still managing to get Troy Fautanu. We talked to Joel Klatt earlier. He has them taking Byron Murphy at number 16. But he did say if Michael Penix is there, that would be his pick. Grab Penix. Penix, Murphy, Latu, Verse, Fautanu, trading back. A lot of options today.
A lot of options. And now the hay really is in the barn as far as the evaluation, and it's dialing in for all of these organizations on what they want to do. We know, and the personnel guys that spoke last week in lieu of John Schneider, and they talked about John really pushing them and challenging them to find more and more and more trade partners, not just on draft day, but even leading up to it and facilitating those kind of trades. That should come with continuity, man. That's one of the reasons that John so often gets these things done and is able to manipulate that board. He's got a lot of relationship with a lot of people all around the league. And if Joel Klatt is right and 6 QBs go before 16, Salk, you are going to be in a sweet spot of either a great talent that falls to you or some needy team that really needs that receiver or really needs that tackle or really needs that edge rusher, maybe even a little bit more than you do at those positions coming up and trading with you.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
I guess I'll just come back to some of the injury updates we got from the Mariners over the weekend. Really good news to see Brian Wu out there and throwing a rehab start yesterday. Went 3 very strong innings, only needed 35 pitches, was not tested. But again, nice to just see him out and progressing. Assuming there's no issues after that, he should try to go, I would think, 60 pitches in his next outing, then maybe one more. And at that point, he should be ready to return. So that's just about 2 weeks. Matt Brash probably going to be at around the same timeline-ish. So all of a sudden, the first or second week of May looks a little fun from a pitching perspective. And I don't know exactly what happens then. These things have a tendency to work themselves out, but Emerson Hancock's been great. He does not deserve to be sent down based on how he's pitched so far. I think that's still what's going to happen. I would be shocked. They are not going to go to a 6-man rotation, but he certainly hasn't done anything to deserve being sent down.
Well, I'll give you 2 other little need-to-knows. Scotty Scheffler finished off the RBC Heritage Salk this morning. He had to play the last couple holes because it got a little too dark with weather issues yesterday. And I don't know if you've noticed, but his caddy has now made more money on the year than Rory McIlroy.
That's insane.
It is absolutely insane.
Well, in his last, 5 events, he has 4 firsts and a second?
It's
I mean, what he's doing right now is, like,
Tiger-esque.
It's insane. Yeah, it really is. And if he starts adding the majors to go with it, yeah, I would say that we'll be having some of those same types of conversations.
And Michael Penix just came out with a little article in the Players Tribune.
I'm excited to read it. So, all right, that's everything you need to know. Let's spend a moment on that before we talk to Jeff Passan a day early here in about 10 minutes. But, Maura, you had a chance to read some of it. I'm excited because I love these Players Tribune articles. Could you read me that last paragraph when you have a moment? I know you're pulling it up, but there was some really cool stuff in there, I thought.
And I think this is also in response to a little bit of what Bruce Feldman said with us a couple weeks ago when he was on, and the article that he wrote about how broken he was.
Yeah.
And I think there was even a little maybe pushback from Michael's agent, like, hey man, you know, I love the transparency and I love how close Michael felt to you that he could share all of that, but you know, can we tell the story a little different?
He said, truth is, I'd be more worried if I had never been injured. We don't all come back the same. I can't speak for those that have never gone through anything, but I can speak for me. I've seen how deep my foundation is. I know the storms I'm prepared to weather. For most people, that'd be the end of their story. But there's more to my story, and I own every page of it.
I like that. I like that point of view of like, hey, some guys get hurt. You don't know what they're going to do. You don't know how they're going to handle it. You don't know whether they're going to be gun shy. You don't know whether they're going to rehab the way I did. I kind of like that. And I can obviously appreciate the idea of embracing your injury past.
Embracing your football mortality.
Well, in his case, yes.
Well, in every player's case, basically. I mean, football ends you. You know, whether it is year eight, whether it's year six, whether it's never getting to the league, you know, football ends. And the majority of the time, it's because physically you're not capable to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Father Time catches up with the greatest that can play 18 or 20 years. But eventually, even those bodies can't sustain and hold up. And certainly the wreckage and carnage, Salk, of so many, where a knee, a shoulder, a blown out back, a Cliff Averill, a Cam Chancellor, whose careers are cut short. I mean, football mortality is a real thing. He stared at it. He stared at it right in the mirror and was able to get past that and put himself back together.
I was kind of looking at it a little bit differently, just thinking about my own life. And we've talked before, you know, about how I hurt my hand when I was 12 and just, you know, the 10 surgeries and month in the hospital. And I wouldn't trade it. I didn't enjoy it. I wouldn't go through it again. But I certainly wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't want my life to be any different now that that's in the past. And I think that I sort of interpret it, maybe I'm projecting a little bit, as sort of the same thing of like, look, those injuries stunk, but I wouldn't trade it because of what I learned, because of how I grew, because of how I matured, because of the person I am now for it. So I really did appreciate
that. Don't let
Michael
that
Penix
define me in weakness.
Right.
Let it define me in strength.
Nice way of looking at it. So he's a pretty impressive dude, man. I understand that you don't think he's necessarily worthy of a 16 pick. I get it. He might not be. But if you really think that he is their future franchise quarterback,
you know,
and like Joel Klatt said,
you know,
he
what
could win a Super Bowl?
We're doing this.
You take that guy at 16.
I know we have Passan next. Tomorrow at 8:30, we're doing this. We're just opening up the phone lines. We're doing it. And whether you want to tell us who they picked, which our buddy Adam did years ago with Bruce Irvin, and he lives in glory forever, or we just want to have a Penix at 16 or not, we are going to do that. I need to hear from the people.
We will make sure the people get their word in before the draft. Coming up next, day early, Jeff Passan on the Mariner weekend and where they're at now that they're just a half a game back at Texas. Stick around. Jeff's up next on Brock and Salk.
This is Brock and Salk.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Weekdays 6 to 10.
On Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
Nice series over the weekend for the Mariners in Colorado. They outscore the Rockies 20-4 and win 2 out of 3 games. That's 5 out of 6. And 7 out of their last 10. Jeff Passan moving some things around and joining us a day early today. Jeffrey, good morning. How are you?
Gentlemen, how are you?
We're doing great. It's fun to see this pitching staff, seriously, when it's doing its thing. They had 8 straight quality starts. That was broken up by George Kirby going 5 innings and not allowing a run. And a few hours later, Emerson Hancock's like, oh, don't worry, I'll start another one with another quality start. That's 10 straight fantastic starts in a row for this rotation. How rare is that?
It's very rare, but it's also not entirely unexpected. This is how the Mariners were going to win, right? This is why people, myself included, were as bullish on them going into the season as they were, because they have the stuff to throw this way every time out. And you've seen other rotations step up so far this season, and it's been unexpected. You know, Boston's rotation has been unbelievable. Kansas City's rotation has been front line. And you look at them, and both are over 500 now, when I think the majority of people in the game didn't anticipate either was going to be over 500 this year. They thought that the Mariners were going to be the ones getting that sort of starting pitching. And look, we can talk all we want about the offense because it's been a mess. But the pitching, man, like the bullpen has been very good this year. And so if you look back at the pitching, it's been the rotation that's been the problematic thing for the first 10 or so games of the season. But man, it has righted itself. And since I came on last week, the Mariners starters have had a 7-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio. None of them in a start has allowed more than one walk. And when you punch guys out, don't walk guys, chances are you're going to be really good. Like, it's this pretty simple formula.
Does Bryce have a chance to put himself in the class with Logan and George?
Yes.
You think his stuff's that good?
I think his stuff's really good. I think, and the thing is, like, adding pitches, when a pitcher adds something, we tend to say, maybe it'll play, maybe it won't. We don't know what it's going to look like necessarily. And I'm going to go to Logan Gilbert actually to start with here, because I think it's important to illustrate what is capable of happening when you add pitches. Last year adds the splitter, right? New dimension comes out in his game. This year adds a cutter. And let me tell you guys, it's not just any old cutter. If you look at Stuff Plus, which is, a metric that looks at the shape of a pitch, the quality of a pitch, Logan Gilbert's cutter is like the best among starters in baseball by Stuff Plus so far this year. It's an elite pitch out of the gate. And we're talking about a guy who throws a bunch of really good pitches already. Well, let's go to Bryce Miller. Adds the splitter this year. And it has become, out the gate, a very good pitch to start off with. And, I understand he had his changeup, and, he was thrown a curveball last year that he's more or less ditched this year. The split for Miller could be a real game changer long term. And when you have a fastball that that grades out as well as this one does, and doesn't just grade out well, but induces the sorts of feeble swings that it has, you don't see many guys who are throwing 60%+ fastballs anymore. I think the splitter allows Bryce Miller to throw as many fastballs as he does, because otherwise guys are just going to sit fastball. And it doesn't matter how good your fastball is, how much ride it has, how much run it has, or what the properties and characteristics are. If you're throwing 60%+ fastballs in 2024, guys are just going to sit on it and tee off on it. But what the splitter does is it mimics the fastball, right? It looks like a fastball, and then it dies. And it is an emasculating pitch when it's thrown well, and he's throwing it really well so far.
Well, and I might even go a step further with him compared to Logan. He needed it more than Logan did, because he had a problem with getting lefties out, such so that I think there was at least some internal talk like, hey, is this guy definitely going to be a long-term starter, or at some point would he have to become a reliever if he can't, get lefties out? All of a sudden today, it looks totally different. He's a 4 or 5 pitch starter who can get anybody out.
Yeah, and look, you could have potentially increased his slider usage against lefties, but the notion that a guy who's only fastball slider is exclusively a reliever anymore, it doesn't quite hold. But man, both of those pitches have to be really good. Like, the guy who was getting away with it before he got hurt was Spencer Strider, and he was almost entirely fastball slider last year, and still did fine against lefties. It just so happens that the fastball and slider that Strider threw were, you know, both top five pitches in the class among all pitchers. So they have to be great pitches in order to survive with that. But what the splitter does is it frees them up. I look at a guy like Brady Singer in Kansas City. He's been two-seamer slider and has been searching for a changeup his entire career and still really hasn't found it consistently. And so there's always that concern with him that as much as his two-seamer moves and as precise as his slider can be, there's still, you're leaving yourself such little margin for error in that situation. The splitter buys you leeway. The splitter is devastating against lefties, and it's really good against righties when you land it in the zone.
Thursday, Friday will be pretty fascinating days in the sports calendar with the draft and trades, and do we take this guy, and what kind of value does he have versus what we have on our roster and everything else. Jeff, I wonder how close the Mariners actually got to trading a Logan Gilbert, to trading a Bryce Miller, to trading a Brian Wu over the last 6 to 9 months.
Not close. And I get it. Even if you can develop good major league pitching, and that's something that the Mariners, the proof's in the pudding, right? Like, they have developed all of these guys. Even when you believe organizationally you have the skill to do that, it's the greatest commodity there is, the greatest commodity in baseball, and it's not even close. And young starting pitching is coveted everywhere. So in order to trade them, you need to ask for and receive a disproportionate return to what the guy's value is in computer systems. And those sorts of trades just very rarely happen these days, where teams are willing to give up more future value for present value. There's just fear, and there's fear, understandably, because the guys throw hard, and guys who throw hard tend to get hurt, and guys who tend to get hurt make for awful trades. So it's almost like, even though the Mariners have this very valuable grouping of players in their young starting pitchers, they will almost never be able to get commensurate value in return for all of the reasons I listed.
Talking to Jeff Passan a day early this week. Jeff, talk to me a little bit. We spent some time last week on technology and on stats, numbers, analytics, etc. But tell me a little bit more about technology. One of the conversations that started here this week was about the iPads on the bench and the Mariners making a concerted effort to maybe look at them less. That led a lot of people to write back on the X platform and say, what, they're just like my middle school kids? Are they just like watching YouTube shorts on the bench? Which obviously is not the case. But maybe you could just shed some light on how that is used in baseball today and why they may have had some success limiting some of that usage.
So there was this pitcher, and I'm just going to use this as an example. There was this pitcher who was a very highly touted prospect, among the best pitching prospects in baseball. And his manager, this was probably a half decade ago, his manager was getting mad at him. And he was getting mad at him because when he was doing his bullpen sessions, for example, after every pitch he threw, he would go and check the iPad to look at what the metrics on the pitch were. He wasn't just looking at velocity, and he didn't care about the location or his execution of the pitch. He wanted to know what the spin was, what the spin axis was, where his fingers were on the ball at release, all of the very little detailed minutiae that exists in pitching labs, right? Where you're trying to create a pitch to do what you want with it movement-wise, rather than trying to throw a ball that feels good, that you can replicate, and that is going to be effective as much because of your comfort with it as the movement profile that the pitch has. Now, I know that that's for pitching as opposed to hitting like we're talking about here. But I think that that to me was a sign of where we were going technologically in this game, where you have a generation of players that is growing up with instantaneous feedback from computers that it has been told, and by it I mean the player, that players have been told are almost like gods staring down upon you and giving you exactly what you need. And there is a very happy medium. There is a very fine line between technology that helps you and technology that winds up getting in your head. In the case of the hitters, quite often they're looking at their swing and they're looking at previous at bats. And I understand the instinct to do that. I just wrote a story this week on an obsessive player who looks at his swing all the time and is always trying to tweak it and iterate in the moment and change things to find perfection. And his name is Corey Seager, and he's a really good baseball player. So for some guys, Mike, that works. For some guys, technology can be inhibiting. And if you know, having a blanket approach in terms of screen time, if you want to call it that, is it may not be the right thing to do, because some guys actually benefit from the use of the screens, whereas other guys, it just burrows deeper into their heads. But the problem in that situation is, well, if Johnny can use his screen, why can't I? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like we're having parenting breaking out on major league benches right here, and balancing that and figuring that out, who gets it, who doesn't, how much he has it, how much he doesn't. It's a very familiar conversation, guys, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it goes all the way back to the 80s. I mean, if we're honest, it goes back to Rocky IV. Right, the ending of the Cold War that Rocky IV did, you know, with Drago's in the lab. He's pounds per square inch. He's getting juiced up on roids. He's wearing his white spandex, doing the VersaClimber. And there's Rocky. I mean, Rocky's just chopping wood. He's running mountains, right? I mean, it just comes back to good old-fashioned feel and toughness versus all the computers.
As long as it's not, like Rocky, as long as it's not like Apollo versus...
No, not at all. Not at all. So I'm wondering, Julio goes eight or...
You must die.
No.
The greatest.
That's not what he says.
Project.
Come on,
this is not the
Jeff,
line, Jeff.
Jeff.
My God.
Come on. I must break you.
I must break you. And if he dies, he dies. Like, come on. When's the last time you saw Rocky IV? Do you even love America?
It's been a long time. The greatest school project I ever did was in. It was like a combined AP U.S. history and AP English class, and we had to do a project on the Cold War, and we made like a 20-minute video that overdubbed Rocky IV with like the Yalta Conference and all the other things that were going on in the actual Cold War. It was, I mean, I was like a, I was a BBC commentator, and I would drop like Johnson's baby powder in my hair to make it white. Like it was pretty good.
So Julio goes 8-14. Do we see an article come out anytime soon? I'm still just kind of waiting on this article.
At least one home run.
It's better. We're getting there. I will say this: his defense remains off the charts good. Yeah. I did not think there was a world in which Julio Rodriguez was going to be in the conversation for being the best defensive center fielder in baseball. We are there now, though. And it's magnificent to see. And every week you guys are going to bug me about the story, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. That's what I do. I'm a middle child left-handed instigator. That's kind of what I am.
Well, here's the thing. I expect it out of Mike Brock.
Right.
Yeah, I don't remember these things. I've already forgotten that you wrote a story. Like, whatever. I'm sure eventually one day that thing will come out. I don't know. I'm too focused on today. I can't remember what you told me 2 weeks ago.
I can. I remember everything. Yeah. What's more surprising, that Julio's become one of the best center fielders in all of baseball, or that Julio Rodriguez could go 22 games without hitting a home run?
Definitely the center field part, because listen, guys go through slumps. Even elite hitters go through slumps, and searching for things and trying to find it. And I think at this point, he's not trying to hit home runs necessarily, and that's a good thing. He, you know, he knows home runs are going to come. He is too big. He's too strong. His swing is too good. He's going to go on a jag here where he hits a bunch of them. That's just, it is an inevitability. I would put a month's salary on it.
I would bet that too, Jeff. I would bet that too, and sorry to cut you off. But I will say what's surprising to me is Jared Kelnick. Jared Kelnick, and totally different guys. Julio is one of the best players in the game, and Jared is, you know, struggling to make it and got off to a great start, but continues to, over the last couple of weeks, really struggle in Atlanta. When we watched him go to Wrigley Field last year and hit home runs that very few humans have ever hit in that place, when we watch Jared up close and personal and you see him, I don't know, split squatting 450 pounds in the amount, back to Drago, of power that that guy has. And then all of a sudden after Wrigley, there was no power. And all season, he's likewise. He's yet to hit a home run this year as well. Is there a point where you can sacrifice contact too much? Or, you know, I'm not comparing him again to Julio. That sounds incredibly foolish. But I guess let's just stick on Kelnick. What has happened? How can you go from hitting 480-foot bombs in Chicago to not hitting a home run?
I feel like it's as much mentality as anything, right? When you hit a 480-foot home run, you are swinging for a 480-foot home run. You are feeling immensely confident at the plate. Mm-hmm. And yes, the natural raw power is there, but when you get like above 450, you're really swinging. And you take those sorts of swings when you're confident in your swing. You don't take those sorts of swings when you're not confident in your swing, when you're struggling. I saw Jackson Holliday here in Kansas City yesterday.
Yeah, what
and
do you think?
He is one for 30 to start his big league career. And he's taking fastballs down the pipe for called strike threes. And he looks absolutely lost at the plate right now. He's going to be fine. He is too good and too talented a hitter and has seen too much good stuff through the years in order to believe that a really bad start is going to hinder him. But let's be honest, right now, Jackson Holliday will not be swinging to hit home run balls. If he hits a home run, it's almost going to be by accident just because he was trying to barrel the ball up and get solid wood on it at all. And, you know, I feel like the home run jag for Julio is coming because he has finally started making more contact. You know, strikeout rate over the last week is still close to 30%, which is not ideal, but making enough contact where now, you know, you ramp up the swing a little bit and you swing a little bit harder and you hope that that bat to ball that's been there over the last week starts translating a little more into those gap to gap and hopefully over the fence shots.
What's going on with the Astros?
I'm beginning to wonder, Mike, if this is actually the year. And look, we've said that in the past, and you know, they've been to every American League Championship Series this decade and going back, you know, almost halfway to the last decade. So it's not like I'm going to count the Astros out now, but just when, you know, Justin Verlander comes back, Framber Valdez looks like he may be returning soon. Christian Javier hit the injured list. Jose Urquidy's there already. Luis Garcia's there already. Lance McCullers is there already. But beyond that, their bullpen's not been good. Their bullpen was supposed to be an extreme strength going into this season. The scariest part for the Astros is that Jose Altuve has been unbelievable and that Yordan Alvarez has been very good and that Kyle Tucker has been very good and that Jeremy Pena has been excellent. And despite those four guys all hitting like you expect them to, the Astros are still behind the A's in the standings. And it gets no easier from here. They've got the Cubs. They go to Mexico City and, you know, with the elevation there, you have no idea what that series is going to look like. They've got Cleveland. They've got the Yankees. They've got the Brewers, or I think the Brewers, and then Detroit after. Like, They've got a run of really good teams here. If they do not turn things around, this has a chance to get ugly. And the only salvation at this point is that the rest of the American League West has been pretty ugly along with them.
So with that, final question for me here, Jeffrey. Tee up the three-game set that begins in Arlington tomorrow. They're off today, and we'll get to see Logan. We'll get to see Bryce. We'll get to see Luis on the third game of that because of the doubleheader and snowstorm. Go ahead, look at those numbers that you love to look at and set up the matchup with the Rangers and the Mariners for the first time this season.
Well, I think at this point, you know, I look at series in the middle of the season not being indicative of a whole lot yet, right? Mm-hmm. To me, this is as much a psychological thing as it is, okay, like how is Logan Gilbert going to do against Dane Dunning, right? How's Bryce Miller going to do against John Gray? Like, we can look at the pitching matchups and all that, but to me, this is the world champions are playing against the Mariners. Let's see how they stack up. Mm-hmm. Let's see how the pitching navigates this lineup that has gotten even deeper than last season. Let's see how this bullpen, which has been really good, like really good. Do you guys realize how good their bullpen's been?
I was trying, unbelievable.
I was trying
and
to
they
text
still don't
Salk
have Brash or Santos. They've been fantastic.
I know. Like that's the wild part. Like Taylor Saucedo's been phenomenal. Miller's been really good. Like they just year after year, it's like, where did this guy come from? And what sort of pixie dust are they sprinkling him with? But how are they going to handle those late innings against, you know, Semien and Seager and Nate Lowe is now back and Carter and Wyatt Langford and Jim Heim? Like, we can go on and on about the number. I didn't even mention Adolis Garcia. Like, this lineup, top to bottom, is nasty. And Mariners fans are going to see what a real productive lineup looks like.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have Mitch Garver in it anymore. So I'm going to guess that's going to be the big difference here in this series. Mitch gets back to Texas, does his thing, and we'll have an interesting conversation.
And we'll
about
send
it
you the video from the race on Thursday.
Yeah, big okay. race. It's coming up Thursday. I did a couch to 5K in one day on yesterday. So I'm ready, Jeff. Yep. Don't worry about it.
Wait, this is a...
Yeah, Thursday. It's happening.
This is a 200, right?
200 meter race, yeah.
So in order to train for a sprint, you ran a 5K?
No, that was just to hang out with my kids. But, you know, it just kind of got me feeling it. Then I went to the track later and, you know, I'm kind of like a thoroughbred. You just put me out on the track and just instinct takes over, I would say.
Oh, yeah. When I look at you, it's the first word that comes to mind.
You know, in fact, do you mind, Salk, if I send him the start that you sent us? And we'll see, you know.
No, I don't think you need to do that.
No, I think I'm going to do that.
I don't really think that's necessary.
No, yeah.
Thankfully, we have this technology, Brock, where if you send it right now, I will receive it when we're still on the air.
Brock's still using the Pony Express. Don't worry about it.
I can absolutely filibuster long enough in order for that technology.
Yeah, we don't need
to
that. We got to go. So Brock's got his draft profile. No, you know, the draft is this week, Jeff. I don't know if you know that, but we got the draft coming.
I don't know why you sent this all, because I've seen you do other athletic things.
This wasn't it?
This was not it. So I don't know. Was this a
joke?
I thought maybe.
First off, is that really your starting position? You look like Rodin's The Thinker. Like, what are you looking for there?
After I smoke more on this 200-yard dash, Jeff, you're going to have to show up here, and I'll do the same thing to you. I'll take on all comers.
Oh, my God. Hold on. The best part is that I'm going slow motion here and just going frame by frame. As you push off, you somehow get into a more hunched position. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Well, you're comparing me to, like, Michael Johnson. I'm not running against a professional sprinter.
I think you kind of trip a little.
Huh?
Do you trip a little
bit? Yeah, I didn't have the right shoes. I'm going to borrow some track shoes for the event, and then it'll be all fine. Jeff, goodbye. We have to go. We don't have time for you anymore. Goodbye.
This is unbelievable.
Goodbye.
The man went for the shoes.
Please go away. We're done. Between you and Clatt on the same day, I can't take it. It's too much attack.
You know, Mike, here's the thing. I will go away, and I'll go knowing that you can't catch me.
Goodbye. My dad says, hey, you know, when you go to the track, they always have an ambulance that follows the horses just in case. He was wondering whether we were going to have one of those for me, which is precious. All right. We'll come right back with Brock's latest draft profile. Can we stop having guests on that are mean to me? Let's just talk to Brock next on Brock and Zach.